Scary Stories by Peter Bernard. Number 1. An Utterly Childish Halloween Prank. Read by Madeline Starr. As a lifelong New York City resident, growing up in the 70s and 80s, Halloween came to mean a very specific thing to me. The Great Pumpkin on TV, giant pumpkins for sale in stores all over the neighborhood, and Halloween decorations everywhere. It's actually far more elaborate now than it was back then, but still largely the same. Halloween to me never meant trick-or-treating down a country lane. It meant trick-or-treating to the local stores, whose owners my parents didn't hate, and at the apartments of the adults who my parents didn't think might try to poison us. And Halloween was also, is also, my birthday. I was the oldest kid in my family and the only girl. My two brothers, Joey and Phil, were 1 and 2 years younger than me, respectively. When we were kids, they would often pull tricks on their big sister, and they constantly told me I needed to get a better sense of humor. Yeah, because a bucket of water balanced on my door that could have given me a concussion when it fell on me is going to get you hired writing comedy for late-night TV, right? Anyway, by the 1980s, we all had nostalgia for those times. So we'd get together each year on Halloween, back here in New York City at my place, and watch something spooky together. I would blow off my other friends to hang out with my bros, and that was my favorite kind of Halloween and birthday. In 2010, it was going to be the 50th anniversary of my birth. My husband and kids were out of town at my request, so I could spend the day with my brothers. This year, Joey said he was bringing an old Super 8mm film starring Phil that I'd never seen before. I was very excited, so you can imagine how upsetting it was when Phil called the night before, asking if he could get out of coming. I asked why and was hurt when he wouldn't even make a good excuse not to come. Finally, he said he was coming, but he was only doing it for me. Then he disconnected the call, and I was left feeling extremely guilty. The next evening, my doorbell rang, and I was happy to see Joey there, armed with a lot of luggage and packages. We hugged and talked excitedly over each other, and he started setting up the Super 8mm projector before even taking off his coat. I laughed and forcibly removed it from him. He had gotten it all set up when the landline rang. He was closer to the phone, so I asked him to pick it up. Joey answered, but instead of handing me the phone, he got a serious look on his face and left the room. I followed him, and when I caught up, he had just hung up. He hugged me and cried, sobbing that Phil had died in an accident on the way over. We both just stood there weeping for what seemed like forever. When our hug ended, I started to ask what happened. But he shushed me and led me by hand out to the living room. He made me sit down, turned out the lights, and began projecting the movie on my wall. It was sound, at first too loud, then he adjusted it. Phil was on screen. He looked 7 or 8 years old. He was wearing a fake mustache and a top hat made out of craft paper. I, the great Philomeno, will now make predictions of the future from here in the present of the year 1970. The camera zoomed in sloppily. I, the great Philomeno, do hereby predict that 40 years from now, my evil sister will prove to be the death of me. I stood up, demanding Joey turn this off. What was he trying to do, torture me? I don't need to see this, Joey, I screamed. Oh, I think you do, he said back so forcefully that I sat right back down. On screen, young Phil was glaring at me. I see you there, in the audience, my evil sister of the year 2010. I see through to the future. You think that just because I am dead that you are safe now. But you are not, for I, the great Philomeno, shall have my revenge. And it shall come right now. Suddenly the lights turned on and someone grabbed me around my neck from behind. I tried to escape, but couldn't, as whoever or whatever it was dragged me over in front of the full-length mirror so that I could see that I was being held by Phil, who was very much not dead in a car accident, and very much giggling like a lunatic, until I turned around and started beating him harder than I'd ever hit a person in my life. How could they both do this to me? This was the cruelest Halloween prank I ever heard of. But when they described the 40 years of work that went into it, I could kind of see how they sort of felt they had to follow through and finish it if we all actually lived this long. I mean, it may be a mean trick, but it's certainly an epic one. I asked them what tricks they planned for me turning 60, but they both assured me they're certain I won't live that long. I love my brothers. Happy Halloween.
Strangest Halloween Story Ever by Peter Bernard. Read by BQ River. This was a story that was told to me in 1975 when I was 13 years old by a kid I was friends with at school, who shall remain nameless. He only told a few of us the story, but it spread like wildfire through all our classmates, and as a consequence, he got bullied and even beaten up because of the weird nature of the tale. He took so much abuse for it that after a while he denied ever having told it. But after hearing the story myself and seeing how he acted afterwards, I'm about 99% certain that, at least to him, these weird events actually occurred. After he stopped telling it, people came to me to hear it, so I told it over and over again and can remember it basically by heart. Here, to the best of my recollection, is the original story, exactly how the kid told me in that playground in the Bronx during that fateful lunch period. Guys, my mom says I'm not allowed to hang out with you anymore, but I want to tell you the full story so you know the reason why, okay? As you may or may not know, my grandfather on my mother's side died last month. He was my favorite relative. He gave me my Ouija board, and he taught me a lot about nature and stuff like that. That's why this past Friday, after trick-or-treating with you guys, my mom and me split for upstate to stay with my grandma for the weekend. Halloween had been her and grandpa's favorite holiday, so mom was worried that she might jump off a cliff or something if she didn't have people around to cheer her up, you know? I seen a show on TV last Saturday starring Herman Munster but without the makeup, and he was saying Halloween is the time of year when the separation between the world of the living and the world of the dead is the thinnest. So, it's easiest to talk to the dead around Halloween, see? And I thought, how boss would it be if I brought the Ouija board Grandpa gave me up to the house and we could all use it to contact Grandpa? Then Grandma wouldn't have to be lonely anymore. Problem solved. So I told my mom my idea, but instead of thanking me, she smacked me right across my face. Man, she hit me so hard almost twisted my neck off. I ran away, but she just kept chasing me around the entire house, smacking my face again every chance she got and yelling something about church or Jesus or something. One time I had my hands up to protect my face and she accidentally hit her hand on my elbow and hurt herself. Wow, did I get creamed for that? Like it was my fault I have elbows? So anyway, that's why I had to put the Ouija board in my knapsack for the trip up. Secretly. It was a nice ride north, watching the sun set and the leaves all different colors. We got to Grandma's just in time for dinner, but I lied and told them both I felt sick from too much Halloween candy and used that excuse to head upstairs to my room Grandma kept for me to stay over in. I pulled off my sneakers, closed and locked the door, and as quietly as I could, I pulled out the Ouija board. I put both my hands on the planchette, and as softly as I could, I whispered, "Grandpa, are you there?" Waited for a while, but there was no answer. Next, I whispered that it was me, and I had come to visit him for Halloween. Still nothing. I kept trying to find various ways of trying to get him to talk to me. I heard someone coming up the stairs. Figured it was my mom, so I threw the planchette and Ouija board in the box, slid the box under the bed. Then, forgetting I had locked the door, I jumped on top of the covers and pretended to have fallen asleep. I laid there for a while, then realized the footsteps had stopped, but nobody had knocked on the door or tried to open it. Wondering what was wrong, I got out of my bed, went over and unlocked the door, opened it, and peered out into the hallway, which was dark. There was no light coming from the partially open bathroom door on the one side, and there was no light coming from any of the bedrooms on the other side. Did whoever had come up the stairs change their mind and head back down? And if so, why hadn't I heard them go back down? Maybe I made too much noise getting into bed to hear it? I went downstairs so I could ask my mom and grandma what had just happened. I found them both in the office, busy talking about boring stuff that made no sense to me. I tried to ask them who had come upstairs, but they were really serious about their boring conversation, and Mom kept telling me to stop interrupting and to shut up. Finally, they seemed to be finished, so I asked Grandma quickly if she had come upstairs a little while ago. She looked at me like I was crazy. I was about to explain why I was asking when she suddenly remembered that Grandpa had told her to give me his telescope when he died. She rummaged through some drawers until she found it. Then she handed it to me and told me to go outside and look at the stars for a while so she and my mother could talk about some important things. Upstate, they have a lot more stars than we have in the Bronx, so up there a telescope can be even more fun than a Viewmaster. Grandpa had showed me how to recognize a few constellations, and we used to spend all night looking up at the sky. He was the only person I ever knew who seemed to be on my side, and I really miss him. Stop laughing. It's all right for a guy to miss someone. Grandma's house had a wooden porch outside the back door that overlooks a nice big backyard that ends in a forest. She kept a few chairs out on the porch. I sat on Grandpa's old cushion one, which still smelled like his pipe. I pulled the telescope out and out until it couldn't stretch anymore, then leaned back and started to looking to see if I could find any stars I recognized. That's when I heard a weird sound from the tree line. I can't even tell you what the sound was, except that it made me feel like throwing up as soon as I heard it. It scared me so much that I couldn't even think about what it was. I just knew it wasn't something good. They have coyotes up there and wildcats that can kill you, and one time I got sprayed by a skunk, which isn't as funny as in the cartoons. I stared at the tree line, trying to force my eyes to see in the dark, you know? I didn't hear or see anything more, so I put the telescope back up to my eye and went back to looking at the stars. That's when I heard another noise. Or really like two or three noises at once. It sounded like someone taking a few quick steps toward me. At the same time, they made a sort of a grunt. Now, I pointed the telescope at the tree line and started refocusing as fast as I could. I still couldn't see anything for a while, until suddenly I could. But it wasn't a coyote or a cat or a skunk or a bear or my dead grandpa. It was some kind of caveman. I swear to you that if I'm lying, I pray that God makes both my little toes fall off, man. Stop laughing. This isn't funny. This was the scariest thing I ever saw. It was a big monkey man, like In Search Of with Dr. Spock, and it was looking at me. I could only really see its face and shoulders in the darkness, but it was definitely looking right at me. at me, just looking. I started to try to estimate how long it would take it to reach me if it ran, and how long it would take me to run inside and lock the door, and I wondered which could happen quicker. Then it took a step forward out of the tree line, and I could get a view of all of him. Through the telescope, I could see he was a whole lot taller than the monkey man on TV, and it didn't have big boobs like that one. It looked like a football player, but taller than a basketball player and covered in dark hair. I don't remember getting up, but I remember being inside and locking the door. I must have left the telescope outside, but I didn't care. I raced into the house screaming that a monkey man was coming and he was going to get all of us. I was crying, man. I admit it. But you would have been crying too. Oh, sure, laugh. But you probably would have wet your panties if you saw this thing, man. I started running to the office, but then I saw my mom and grandma coming down the stairs holding something and looking really mad at me. Was my Ouija board, which meant she had just searched the friggin' room for some reason. She said she was looking to make sure I wasn't hiding any extra Halloween candy, but I think she's just a spy who likes to be a jerk, is what I think I told her. I'm not a little kid anymore, and she had no right to do that, and she told me that when I could afford to move out. Then I wasn't a little kid anymore, and she just picked me up and carried me over to the chair by the window and pulled my pants right down in front of Grandma. She started spanking me with my bare butt facing out the window towards the forest where the caveman was. I was praying he'd left by now, and that I wouldn't have to be killed by a monster with my butt sticking out. I screamed for Grandma to help me, but she just said Mom wasn't hitting me hard enough, and I had disrespected her husband's memory by bringing a devil board into the house. I tried to remind her that Grandpa gave it to me, but that only made her angrier, and she took her turn to spank me next. Grandma's a lefty, so she had to face me the other way, and this time I could look out the window while being beaten. And I saw it. The caveman monkey was still there, and he was still staring at me. I stared back into his eyes, and for some reason, I didn't feel any more of the spanking, and I didn't feel scared anymore. I just stared at him, and he stared at me. When Grandma was done, he seemed to take a step backwards while still looking at me, and I couldn't see him anymore. So today, Mom is making me quit the youth group and debate team. She says I'm grounded from everything besides school and church until Christmas. I'm not allowed to watch creature features on Saturday nights anymore, and I'm not allowed to hang out with you guys on lunch anymore, because Mom says you're the reason I do bad things. And he never did hang out with us anymore. His family moved away quickly around Thanksgiving, and I never heard from him again. I don't think he made this story up, although I guess he might have just been crazy. Either way, that kid is the reason why, for my whole life, I've always lumped ghosts, Bigfoot, UFOs, and anything weird all together. I have a feeling that somehow they're all part of the same thing, at least in some way. And that story is the reason I never play around with Ouija boards, especially around Halloween. Happy Day of the Dead!
It's a strange world that we live on indeed. If you've read any of the material by John Keel, such as Our Haunted Planet or Disneyland of the Gods, you'll know pretty much what I'm talking about. One of the things that I've noticed over the years, that if you take a camera with you, whether it's a still camera, digital camera, or a camcorder, if you take it to an area of intense paranormal activity, whether it be a place that's said to be haunted, like a graveyard or an eerie dwelling, or even to spots or window areas where UFOs have been seen frequently. If you take photographs, sometimes you will be able to get on the film or on the video things that are not visible to the human eye. It's very eerie, very strange, but it does happen. So this is an excerpt from the book our alien planet, this eerie Earth. It's a collection of material, research that I've done over the years, which proves that our planet is actually an intelligent, conscious being that tries, through various means, to communicate with us. And the subhead is called Rockin' in the UK. Don't think that all the action is here in the United States. The whole world has us in its hands, it would seem. While I was in Britain speaking at the House of Lords, I gave a few lectures for groups holding retreats in England's plush countryside. I even slept in a windmill that had been converted into a number of rooms where conference attendees stayed. Of course, I wanted to visit Stonehenge and feel its energy for myself. And I wanted to pay a special visit to see journalist Arthur Shuttlewood, whose book, UFO Prophecy, I had published in the States. Arthur had made the transformation from UFO skeptic to hardened UFO believer after countless UFO sightings and close encounters had taken place in and around his hometown of Warminster, a quaint hamlet located only a few scant crop circles away from Stonehenge. As the editor of the Warminster Journal, Arthur was being faced with a personal crisis. His pragmatic ways were being challenged by that which he knew couldn't possibly be true, but which his own eyes, as well as photographic evidence he was constantly presented with, told him must be. On cloudless starry nights, believers and skeptics alike would gather on Star Hill and Cradle Hill outside the town of Warminster to watch for the visitors who had often been mentioned in legend and lore. I was invited to attend one of these impromptu sky watches. And the unexpected did happen. Now, I really hadn't gone to Warminster thinking about seeing a UFO, because I have a reputation of being somewhat of a reverse magnet for UFOs. If I'm around, most likely nothing will appear, even though I have had 3 sightings of my own, which I can't explain. But usually if you're out on a sky watch and you're waiting for them to show, whatever them might be, you might be disappointed. So I hadn't gone there with really any expectations of encountering anything highly unusual, but I was wrong. I was standing on a hillside just out of town. I was with Arthur Shuttlewood and Bob Strong, who I had just met. He's a retired World War II fighter pilot who had filled 2 or 3 large scrapbooks with photos showing a variety of fluttering and fleeting objects that had been seen overhead over Warminster. One of the things Bob commented on, which I thought particularly strange at the time, was how when he got the pictures back from the lab, actually I think he sent them out to the local pharmacy to be developed, the objects he and others had seen with the naked eye had changed shape. Some of the objects had bat-like wings. Some were of impossible shapes and of tremendous size, though other photos showed streaking lights that were tiny as cigarette lighter flames. On the night in question, along with the others present, I did see something strange, a bright orb hovering in the sky. I can't tell you what it was for sure, but when we retrieved the flashlight out of Arthur Shuttlewood's car and began signaling to the object, blinking at it in some sort of code that we had made up. It wasn't Morse code, because we certainly didn't know that. But every time we would blink at the object with the flashlight, it would respond by blinking back at us, or at least seemingly blinking back at us, and moving back and forth as if dangling on a string. The UFO eventually disappeared behind some low-hanging clouds and never reappeared. However, the incident was not over. During our hours-long sky watch, I took a photo of Bob Strong and a lady by the name of Eva Alcock, who was among the sky watchers. Understand, it was pitch black out, and so it was impossible for me to focus the lens of the camera. That's why the picture, and I have published it in several different publications, that's why the picture shows everyone blurred. Later, when the roll of film was developed, I was surprised to discover a strange object behind the 2 people in the photo. Again, there were no lights out in the field. It was dark as hell. Yet there, behind the 2 people in the photograph, is a bright form zipping around straight out of the sky. Apparently, the camera had managed to catch something that was invisible to those of us standing in the field. The photograph, which actually is a slide, the original, is quite colorful, as the object is of various hues. Later, I discovered that other photographs had been taken in this area, and they also showed strange things that people were not able to witness while apparently these manifestations were taking place. In my files, I have a puzzling photo, and this is in the book, Our Alien Planet. In my files, I have a puzzling photo showing a man standing next to a car near where we had our sighting. It's high noon, and yet a portion of the sky is blacked out by a large, ominous shape that was not detected at the time, despite its enormous size. The object is on two frames of the 35mm film that was taken by John Wright at the foot of Star Hill. A check of his equipment showed no defect. He says he saw nothing unusual, but was aware of a deadly silence that seemed to fill the air at the time. Sometime later, when discussing the incident with John Keel, author of Our Wanted Planet and Mothman Prophecies, he said that he knew of yet another photograph that he thought would be of interest to me, and it had been taken in the same area. Keel reminded me of the 1964 case involving a strange image caught on film of what has been dubbed a spaceman. Jim Templeton, an English fire officer in the Cumberine Fire Service, had been on a picnic with his family on the marsh. He took a series of photographs, and when the film was developed, the prints revealed something that was not seen. The photo is of Templeton's 5-year-old daughter, Elizabeth. What makes the picture so strange that in the background, right over her shoulder, is what appears to be a figure dressed in what best could be described as a white spacesuit and wearing a helmet. Templeton said he was flabbergasted. The only other people around were two ladies who sat in their car some 300 or 400 yards away. Keel says that the family recalled the air felt unusually quiet and that normally there would be cows and sheep grazing everywhere. However, on this particular day, the only animals to be seen were huddled on the far side of the marsh. Kodak became intrigued with the photo, and as a promotional stunt offered free film for life to anyone who could explain the photo, since they could find no evidence of a hoax. No one ever took Kodak up on their offer, and who or what on earth would have the technology to be invisible yet show up on film? Invisibility is an eerie phenomena, one that seems closely allied with our alien planet.
The true story of fake Bigfoot, as told to Peter Bernard by Bigfoot, read by PQ River. Ever since junior high school, my nickname has been Bigfoot because I was always the tallest kid in my class. I've been 6'10" in my bare feet since I was 21. In fact, when I was around that age, one Halloween while out for trick-or-treating, my buddies Lanny, Marco, and Jamie said I should dress up as Bigfoot and they'd film me scaring people. They made it sound like it would be fun, and I liked the idea of getting to be the star of something. Sounds dumb and vain looking back on it, but that definitely was part of why I went along with them. We debated buying a ghillie suit, you know, one of those hunting suits that looks like you're covered in grass during the day or covered in long hair at night. But then Lanny remembered his uncle owned a costume shop about 2 hours' drive from where we lived. Next payday, me and my buddies chipped in and got ourselves a really decent Bigfoot costume, large enough for me to fit into. Lanny's Uncle Johnny built and fitted himself and gave us the family discount. The face mask was a one-of-a-kind from a mold Uncle Johnny broke afterward. Seems he was a bit of a prankster himself, and he said a generic mask wouldn't seem convincing if anyone got a photo of me in the costume. This way, people might be less sure if it was a hoax. The arms and legs had those extra muscles built in that exaggerated the muscle movements of my legs under the fur, and a water bag in the belly area caused the front to bend and wiggle in a frighteningly realistic manner. The feet were really comfortable running shoes on the inside. In the front was some kind of small contraption that bent in such a way that the mechanical toes would curl forward to grasp the earth when I'd bend the foot's arch backward. The footprints it left looked like a living thing made them, in the opinion of all four of us, and we'd been tracking game for all our lives. It was really a masterpiece created on a budget. Uncle Johnny had really dealt us a solid. The first time we decided to use the costume, I got changed in the back of Marco's van. The material stretched and it fit me like a tight glove, so I had to be naked underneath. Even though it was so tight, I could move pretty well in it. At first it was hard to see out of the mask, but Marco, who was then and is still a sculptor, fixed the eye sockets to be much wider. He also repainted them so that even in broad daylight, the mask looked pretty realistic and frightening. We never went out in daylight with the costume, though. This was right after that guy in a ghillie suit got run down by a 14-year-old girl driving on the highway, so of course my buddies wanted me to stand in the middle of the highway screaming. Instead, I gave them directions to a lonely country road that I knew was used as a lover's lane. Sure enough, when we got there, we could see a number of cars parked under the full moon, and some of them were rocking. After dodging questions about why I never shared the secret location with them, I directed them to a place we could park unseen by the people in the other cars. The real reason I kept this to myself was that I'd been dating a girl who didn't like my buddies, so I kept her a secret from them because I didn't want to risk hurting their feelings unless she and I got serious enough to warrant it, which we didn't, but I always remembered this place. So now, there we were. The boys wanted to film me doing my thing, so we'd plan each act out in advance, and I'd tell them where to stand to get the best shot. We pulled so many Bigfoot pranks, it's hard to remember or count them all. The very first one, though, I'll never forget. I chose a car and crawled on the dirt up to the side of it. Slowly, quietly. I raised my head to peek in the window. It was my dad! And the woman with him was not my mom. I happen to know my dad keeps a gun in the glove compartment, so trust me, I retreated as quickly as I had approached. I hightailed it back to the van with all the guys laughing hysterically that I didn't recognize my own father's car in the dark. I've probably learned more about life as Bigfoot than I ever did as myself. But I'm not suggesting this is a hobby, and I urge you against doing the stupid things I've done. Or at least, if you're going to do it, take more precautions than I did. After the run-in with my dad made me realize I could get shot doing this, we had Uncle Johnny sew Kevlar in around the chest of my head and my family jewels. He told me it would make the costume less realistic looking, but I told him, I don't care. As long as it keeps me realistic in the sense of continuing to breathe. But there really is no safe way to go sneaking around in the night dressed up as a cannibalistic monster. For us, it quickly moved beyond being a hobby to being a dangerous obsession. We started Googling legends and folklore of the states in our part of the country. Then we create a prank specific to that local legend and go and perform it like live Bigfoot street theater. On our really special nights, we'd even make the local paper TV news the next day. Like one time, we went to a small wooden-covered bridge that a troll had been rumored to have lived under back in colonial times or Civil War times or something a long time ago. So for that one, I'd jump out and pretend I was trying to grab at cars driving into the bridge. One of them almost skidded into the wall and the drivers panicked to escape. We decided to move the operation to the other side and only jump out at cars that had already passed through in order to prevent accidents. See, we were civic-minded Bigfoot pranksters. So we stalked each lover's lane in the tri-state region. We built a Bigfoot tree structure on the edge of a cornfield, and we left Bigfoot tracks in the mud by every stream we encountered in 3 years. We travel to areas where the Bigfoot Hunters TV show would call local meetings, then go into the forest, knocking on trees and yelling like Bobo. We think one time one of Marco's screams actually got on their show, with Matt, of course, insisting it was real. We can't be sure, but it sure sounded like Marco, and we were in that general area. Each time we'd appear at a lover's lane, the next day a search party would scour the woods, so we'd have to stay away from that area until things cooled down. In the meantime, we'd create a new flap somewhere else. Eventually, we started targeting camping sites while waiting for our more prime locations to get less hot. We decided to target this one trailer that was parked away from all the others. With my buddy stationed in the woods out of sight, ready to record it all on video, I approached the trailer slowly and quietly. When I got to the side, I stood as tall as I could and banged it with both fists as high as I could reach. Then I let out as loud and deep a scream as I could manage. I was mid-scream when a red-faced man nearly my size carrying a rifle burst from the trailer screaming back at me. My scream just stopped and I ran as fast as I could back into the woods not looking behind. He fired once and hit the tree in front of me to my left. He fired again and got me on my back on the left side. The Kevlar saved my life, but the power of the shot spun me in a circle and I tripped and fell before rolling into the forest, getting back up to run again from there. I ran and the guy chased me, screaming that he hated boogers and he was going to kill me. I just kept running and running until I couldn't hear him anymore. I fell back against a tree and collapsed, chest heaving, trying to catch my breath. I closed my eyes and tried to keep listening to hear what I could over my own breath, and eventually everything was quiet again. I glanced around and realized I didn't recognize anything. Choices were either to head back to the location my friends were last at and risk getting shot, or try to walk home dressed as Bigfoot and risk getting shot. I figured my buddies had probably also run when they heard the gunfire, so I really had no way of even telling where they would be. Incredibly, in my head, I wasn't thinking, if I survive this, I'll never imitate Bigfoot again. Instead, I was thinking, if I survive this, I need a hidden cell phone built into the costume somehow so I can call the guys and pick me up. Like I told you, this had become an obsession. Luckily, this particular prank was at a campground only a mile as the crow flies from my grandfather's cabin, which would be empty this time of year. There were probably some old grandpa clothes there I could change into, and it's possible his phone line might even be working, although that was always a gamble out there. I stared at the stars long enough to get my bearings and headed off to Grandpa's place. The walk took longer than I expected, and it was all uphill, and the brush was very thorny. When I finally got to the clearing his house is at the center of, I stopped short. There were lights on in the house. I moved behind a tree and peeked out. I definitely saw a figure moving inside the house. Was it Grandpa? Who was it? Thinking like a Bigfoot, I grabbed a few pebbles and started hurling them at the house. One of them hit a window and the curtains pulled back to show Grandpa. So it was him, which was not a good thing. Grandpa, like my dad, always had loaded firearms at arm's reach. I had started walking toward the house when it occurred to me he wouldn't be able to tell it was me. He'd think I was really a Sasquatch. I had to try to get this mask off somehow so that he could see my face. I pulled parts of the mask off hurriedly as I stepped back towards the woods. As I heard the back door to the house open, Grandpa stepped out and shouted, "You there, who are you?" Ducked down as quickly as I could behind a tree stump. Unsteady from the sudden movement, I reached out to steady myself on the tree behind me, which was unexpectedly furry. Looking up, I saw that I was leaning against the legs of an extremely tall, extremely confused-looking man-like creature. I kid you not, it looked like a Bigfoot, but at the same time it didn't. It was far more human than my mask, and although covered in fur, it was much less hairy than the big feet they show on TV. Although I'm quite certain that it was extremely and proudly male, as the sparse hair made no effort to hide this at all. I remember high-pitched screaming like a little girl, then realizing that was me making that noise. I was running toward the house, no longer caring what I looked like. "Grandpa, Grandpa, don't shoot! It's me, Grandpa, it's me!" Fortunately, Grandpa recognized my voice before he shot, and he took me in and got me changed and out of makeup. I'd soiled myself, so I didn't just look like a skunk ape, I smelled like one too. I met his mistress, who was only a few years older than me and quite pretty. Now I knew why he was there on a night when he shouldn't be. Grandpa promised me that if I didn't tell anyone about his girlfriend, he wouldn't tell anyone about me dressed as a monkey, screaming like a little girl and crapping my pants. Sounded like a fair deal to me if I ever heard one. So that, my friends, is the sad, sad tale of why I no longer dress up as Bigfoot. The happy ending is this. I got $1,350 for the costume on eBay.